Well, thanks so much for joining us this morning, Evan Bray. Great to have you here on this Tuesday morning. So far, it's looking to be a fairly nice day in the province. I know there's the possibility of some isolated showers that could roll through at some point today, but for the most part, looking as if it's going to be a day of drying or continued harvest for those parts of the province where harvest has not had to stop as a result of the rain. How many times on this program are we drawn to speak about protests? Because protests are happening. I will suggest protests are happening more frequently, more often today than they ever have happened in society. I think back to my time with the police service. I mean, we talked about it then, and this was now a couple of years ago, where it was important for police officers to receive training and education on what people's rights are, the right to protest, the right for peaceful assembly, the right freedom of speech, all of those things, and then understand if those rights go too far. So if someone, you know, obviously commits a crime, those types of things, that sort of education is important for police personnel to be trained in, because protesting has been a cornerstone of democracy in Canada for years. But understanding the rights, if you're in the protest group, when you're gathering, when you're marching, when you're speaking out, if you are part of the protest group and you understand your rights, I think it makes for a much better interaction with all involved. So to help with this, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, known as the CCLA, has recently released an updated Know Your Rights guide for the fall of 2025. It's basically designed to help people understand what freedoms they have under the charter, how to navigate encounters with police or other authorities. And so this is one of those that I think many might hear the topic and go, well, is this set up for a bit of a clash between, you know, the protesters screaming back at the police, we know our rights? I don't believe that's the concept behind it. I think it's more of a, if you all have the same education about what rights are, it should be a smooth interaction. But I wanted to dig into this a bit, and I'm happy to have Shakir Rahim, who is the Canadian Civil Liberties Association Director of Criminal Justice, joining us by phone. Shakir, thank you so much for taking this call today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
So I just set the context there. Can you walk us through what this guide is and what I think what the organization hopes to accomplish with publishing it?
Of course. Well, you know, the guide is really about helping folks understand, as you mentioned, what their rights and obligations are during a protest. I think many people might get their information about protesting or police or what have you from what they may have seen on TV or heard about from a friend. And we just want to ensure that there is a source of information that's vetted and accurate that they can refer to. And so what the guide does is it answers a lot of questions that people might have, like, you know, do I have a right to protest? And what's the scope of that right? If I'm at the protest and I interact with the police, what can I be asked or not asked? Or what do I have to do if the police tell me to do something? If I see an issue during the protest, where can I go? How can I raise my concerns? So it's providing that source of information for everybody involved, so that people can exercise their charter rights in a lawful and peaceful manner.
I mean, this can only be a positive if both sides, and I mean both sides, because there's an onus on whether it's police or authorities involved with a protest to understand the protester's right. We often would talk in policing about we are there to, number one, maintain safety and peace for everyone, including the protest group, because when done lawfully, they need to be served by the police just as much as the people who may be the subject of the protest. So what would you say some of the key takeaways from your training guide are?
Well, I think one of the important takeaways is understanding, first off, you know, the difference between peaceful protest and protests that may go beyond that line that could result in criminal charges. So we talk about what some of the differences are between those forms of expression. At the same time, we also talk about how, you know, police obviously play an investigative function with respect to criminal offenses and other matters, but that doesn't necessarily mean that a person interacting with the police, for example, has to answer every question, right? We have a right to remain silent, or people have the right to walk away. So we talk a little bit about, you know, saying, look, the police do have certain abilities to ask questions or make directions, but there's also another set of rules that talks about, you know, what you have to do in response or what you can or cannot do. So we provide information about that so that folks are able to know that when they actually encounter or navigating a situation with the police, what it is that they are legally obligated to do versus what may be optional and up to their discretion to decide.
Shakir Rahim is the Director of Criminal Justice with the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Do you think this knowledge that is contained in this guide can actually provide a de-escalation effect when tensions arise in a protest?
Absolutely, I do, because it ensures that everybody has a shared understanding of what their obligations are, both the police and those who are protesting, so that it reduces the effect or risk of miscommunication or misunderstanding. I also think it's a good way to think about how the right is expressed, that it doesn't have to be, as you say, some type of combat or clash, but rather we think about how are the police ensuring that this freedom of expression, this right in the Charter, is expressed in a way that is lawful and peaceful. And of course, in our history, there have been times when protesters might have veered into violence. There have been times when police might have veered into an unlawful response. And so it's really about educating everybody involved so that we ensure that we can uphold the Charter and do so in a way that is peaceful and lawful.
So when we're looking at the guide, the Know Your Rights guide that we're talking about, how do you broach the topic of, you know, I think back to many years of protests. If we knew a protest was planned for the legislature this afternoon at 2 o'clock, often someone within our organization, the police service, would reach out to the protest group. And there would be, in many cases, a very good back and forth piece of communication so that everybody kind of understood, okay, here's the rules, here's the responsibilities. Is that encouraged in this guide, that opening of the communication, whether it be with police or other officials that might be involved?
We don't specifically address that in this guide, but certainly I would say that if a group feels that they're able to organize their demonstration in a way that's safe and effective by having that kind of communication, that it absolutely makes sense. Of course, at the same time, some protests might be more spontaneous, or they might arise in a way that kind of communication with leadership is more difficult. And so in those instances, I think it is helpful that the guide does talk about kind of what the base ground rules are. So whether it is a more structured and organized protest where you might have that communication, or one that is more disorganized or spontaneous, at least that bedrock of information is available to everybody.
Shakir Rahim, the Director of Criminal Justice for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. I think currently, and if we look at just even the last 12 months of protests that have been through the windshield of us as Canadians, and that would, I would guess, include some things that happen in the States, often what happens is the protest may start out as a peaceful, lawful protest. The intent is for it to be peaceful and lawful, but organizers can't always control everyone who shows up, and you might get someone who picks up a brick, who brings a weapon, who does something that takes the protest offside. Is there any education or discussion that Canadian Civil Liberties Association has through this guide with protesters and organizers about that?
Well, certainly we talk about the demarcation between peaceful protest and protest where you may face a criminal charge or sanction. So in that sense, I think we do address those differences. We also do, talk about the fact that, just because whether it's one protester or one officer who might behave outside of the scope of what is lawful doesn't render either the enforcement side or the expressive side not permitted to do what they need to do there. So I think we provide some of that nuance about, look, you know, this is never going to be a perfect situation. There's always going to be some dynamic factors, some different forms of behavior you have to take into account, but everyone still has to ensure that they're being on side, whether that is ensuring that the protest is peaceful or ensuring that the policing of the protest is within the established requirements.
Shakir Rahim is my guest, Canadian Civil Liberties Association. I want to shift gears while I've still got you, Shakir, because I used to be part of an organization with the police service where we were calling on the federal government to do a better job of collecting data in a few areas. It had to do with shootings in Canada, firearm, those types of things. Your organization is also calling on the federal government for better data, standardized data. In your case, when it comes to bail reform, can you help us understand why that's important for your group?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, it might come as a surprise to folks, but no government currently tracks the rate of reoffending while on bail. And we know that that's often in the discussion about bail reform. And we think it's really important that we have an accurate picture of what is going on in the bail system before making any kind of legislative or policy changes. You know, public safety absolutely matters. Everyone should be able to feel safe walking down the street or in their home. But we also have to remember that bail also protects many people who are innocent. You know, half of criminal cases do not result in a conviction in Canada, and the majority of people who are out on bail don't reoffend. And so if we restrict bail for the wrong people or the wrong cases, then some people are going to lose their job, connections to their family and their friends, etc., for offenses they never actually committed. So we think it's really important that any reform is targeted and evidence-based, and that's where the bail data collection comes into play and why we think it is important.
There have been some studies on this, Shakir. Is it just that there's not a consistency? Like, I'm looking at one from Justice Canada from 2017. It shows about 18% of accused people released on bail violate one or more conditions of their release. So it's, you know, a little fewer than one in five is according to this. But is it that you don't feel it's consistent enough?
That's correct. So, for example, even in a statistic like that, we can't really break down what is the offense that they were charged with. So, you know, bail conditions, as you know, can be quite broad. Some can be less serious in nature. Others can relate to an actually committing an alleged offense. So we don't have the ability to actually track, like we do, let's say, with certain crime reporting statistics, like the Uniform Crime Reporting Survey, over a period of time, what the rate of reoffending might be, what the alleged offenses are. So to really zero in on some of those cases we hear about in the headlines, it would be helpful to see what patterns can we find, what specific conditions do we need to pay attention to. This is the kind of breakdown and analysis that we're unable to do with the current data that we have.
So I mean, I'm a fan of more data. I think more data, as you point out, doesn't matter what the topic is, helps you make more informed and precise decisions. But help me understand why it matters. If a person is found to have breached the release condition, why does it matter what condition it was or what manner of breach it was?
Well, for example, there was a prominent Supreme Court of Canada case called R.V. Zora in the last few years that spoke about how some conditions that were placed on people were really difficult for some individuals to comply with, but it didn't have to do with the underlying reasons why we have bail in the first place. So some people, for example, who had longstanding addiction issues were receiving conditions of abstaining from any use of alcohol or another substance when maybe their charge was related to that, but that's a condition that someone who has a health issue is going to have a really difficult time abiding by. Or some people may have gotten conditions that said, you know, don't go to this geographic zone, and it was a really broad zone, but it's the only place that they might have been able to access some essential care, you know, medical care or what have you. So Now, that's, of course, different than someone allegedly reoffending, committing the same offense. So it's being able to distinguish between those types of conditions and then being able to make law and policy based on that that we think is really important.
Shakir, appreciate you joining us today. Thanks for giving us the time for the chat.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Shakir Rahim, Canadian Civil Liberties Association Director of Criminal Justice. And it's an interesting topic. I would guess most in the justice system would not be opposed to better data. Where you may see a difference of opinion is the need to hold offenders accountable after a breach has been occurred. And by the way, often when we talk about this, we talk about bail reform. I think it's really broader, more broad than that. It's got to do with when you're released on an undertaking, on a recognizance. There's various forms of release. Bail is one part of a type of release back into the community while either you're awaiting trial, going through a trial. And so it's, to me, bail sometimes is a bit of a narrow escape on a topic that should be much more broad. You're listening to 980 CJME and 650 CKOM.